We have quite a new crowd this week in the village, and so I'll begin with my name. I'm Jerry Folk, and I'm the director of the Shalom Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I work part-time for the American Lutheran Church as the director of Peace and Justice Ministries. And I announced four topics this week, two of which I haven't really done exactly before, so I'm not promising a whole lot, but I have... It is not a subject that's new to me. I've, over the years, been involved in these subjects quite a bit. It's just that I haven't worked with them in recent times. And when you're at Holden, most of you know you don't have your whole library with you, so you can't always get a hold of what you might like to get a hold of. But I think that there are some good things for discussion and for consideration. And I ask your indulgence if it isn't as perfectly organized or as clearly presented as it might be. What I wanted to talk about today are political models for the future. I believe that it's clear to most of us that things are not working very well in our world today. All the way from individuals and families up through international relations. Something seems to be out of kilter, and the institutions which have emerged in the course of human history in some cases do not seem to be adequate to deal with the problems that the human race is confronting today. And I believe that problems of the human community are a major concern for Christians, because Christians believe that God loves the human community and wants the best for it. Now, I wouldn't even want to try to begin to analyze all the structural problems that are contributing to the crisis situation in our world today, but I want to focus on the political institutions of the world and talk about them in light of our situation at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, suggest maybe some reasons why they aren't able to function very well. And the first part of this thing I call beyond the nation state. As you know, the political system according to which the globe is organized, the planet is organized, is a system of sovereign nation states. This means that each national community considers itself to be totally sovereign unto itself. It has no responsibility to any higher authority. It can do exactly as it pleases. Many have come to believe, and I agree with them, that under those circumstances, there never can be peace on earth. That when we have a world like that, what we essentially have is chaos on the international level. You know, we've organized our communities locally, even beginning with our families. We have a certain system of order within our families. And we have an orderly system in our communities. We have a police and a fire system. We have structures and institutions that are able to cope with the crises which those communities might meet. We have a system of order on the level of state, on the level of region, and on the level of nation. But on the international level, on the global level, we have no system of order. The only order that pertains is the order of might, the order of the lynch mob. Whoever can amass the biggest guns, the most amount of them, can do whatever he or she, or whatever the nation wants to do. It's sort of like, Lowell mentioned this in a session of his last week, the Wild West was in the early days, where there was no law and order system. Now, that is a situation in which the law of the jungle essentially pertains, except it's even worse than the law of the jungle, because in the jungle there are ecological dynamics and relationships that pertain and regulate the environment and keep the environment within certain parameters. There have been political scientists recently that have investigated this problem, and of course the real urgency is illustrated by the fact that now these nation states have developed weapons which are powerful enough to destroy not only the human community, but to render the globe itself as an essentially uninhabitable environment for higher life forms. And we talked quite a bit about that last week. The problem is exacerbated. It's brought to its extreme by the fact that we have no order system on the global level. We have these totally sovereign nation states, each one of which claims there's nothing, no authority to which it must submit. And these nation states now have the capacity to destroy one another and to destroy the globe and to destroy the human population. A German political scientist recently did a graph in which he showed, he interrelated weapons technology and the year. And he said that by the year 2000, we will either have solved the problem of global order or we will have exterminated ourselves as a species. And there are many others who believe that that is true. It used to be a wild, way-out idea of some crazy people associated with the World Federalist or some other group. That's the way most people looked at it. But now, a larger and larger chorus of people are pointing out to the human community that we cannot go on indefinitely without developing some kind of a global order system. A system of global authorities, a system of global structures that is capable of dealing with the problems of the human race, which cannot be dealt with by individual nation states. Lowell, I thought, had a very appropriate phrase last week in one of his sessions when he said the challenge in that respect is to invent a system which has enough authority, enough power to do what it has to do, but which is limited enough so as not to become tyrannical and dictatorial. That's the real problem, the real challenge that the human race faces. People have some of the names who've been associated with this world order movement are Lewis Zone and Richard Clark. In their very massive book, very definitive book, World Peace Through World Law, you see, we have the reason we have order in our communities, in our nations, in all the lower communities, is because we have law, and we have the agencies, the structures, the institutions necessary to enforce that law, to require that people in those communities live by that law. But on the international level, there is no law. And what laws there are cannot be enforced because there are no agencies with the authority and the power to enforce international law. It is abided by only if the nations of the world decide they want to abide by it. So Lewis Sohn and Clark argue that the only way to have an ordered international community is to extend the benefits of the rule of law to the international community as we now enjoy those benefits on our national and local communities. And in order to do that, of course, there have to be institutions developed that can enforce international law. Richard Falk, who teaches at Princeton University and runs a center there for world order, has written a book called This Endangered Planet, in which he points out that the actual threats to survival which the human race faces on the planet cannot be met apart from some kind of a global world order system. Saul Mendelowitz, who was for a long time the director of the Institute for World Order, has written a number of books on this subject, and the Institute for World Order has produced what they call the WOMP Project, the World Order's Models Project. 7 different teams throughout the world have been put together, each one asked to envision its ideal world order system. There's a little animated movie that I showed in some of my peace studies classes at Bethany College a few years ago called Voyage to Next. It's about 10 or 15 minutes long, and I would recommend it to any of you that are in parishes that might want to discuss this subject, or in high schools or colleges. In fact, I showed it at my daughter's elementary school, and it seemed to provoke some interest there as well. But it's a dialogue between Mother Earth and Father Time. And Dizzy Gillespie is the voice of Father Time in this movie. Mother Earth keeps telling Father Time to give her more time and things will come out all right. And Father Time keeps saying, well, we don't have all the time in the world, you know. And it shows these human beings building these nation states and arming themselves and gobbling up the resources of the world. And then there's a kind of imaginary dream quality kind of thing at the end, where these people get together and they imagine their preferred worlds. It's kind of fun as a way of introducing this subject. But recently, the church has gotten in on this, and it seems to me it should have been in on it a long time ago. John the 23rd, when he wrote his last writing, called Pacem in Terris, one section of that writing, Peace on the Earth, was devoted to this subject. And he was pointing out that we could not have peace until we had some sort of a system of global order and the institutions necessary to enforce it. He sent a copy of that encyclical by means of his personal emissary, Cardinal Augustin Bea, to the United Nations. And it was only a few months after that his successor, Pope Paul VI, was addressing the United Nations, and this was a momentous occasion. John Paul II, as you may recall, recently addressed the United Nations as well. The popes and others have have considered the possibility that the United Nations itself could develop into this kind of a world order system, this kind of a world order forum. And they have suggested reforms in the United Nations. They have done what they can to enlist the support of the Christian community behind the UN, because they believe that it is a promise of what could be. Bill Lazarus, William Lazarus, who formerly taught at Gettysburg's, at Philadelphia Seminary in the Lutheran Church, and the LCA has put out statements on this subject, and they've come essentially to the same conclusion, that the problems of the world today require some sort of a global order system. And it's not only the problem of war, that's the most extreme one, and the most obvious one, but it's also problems like economic destitution and the management of the environment, which require cooperation across international boundaries, and which require superimposed, Pope said. Pope made it very clear that he built his encyclical on what he called the principle of subsidiarity. The lowest possible authority does whatever it can do. It's only when the problem is such that that authority, like the city authority, can't deal with it, that it's passed on to the next level. And he made it clear that he's not talking about a world government which would just blot out nations and all that, but he's talking about the creation, superimposed over all these other world, all these other systems of order, of a global structure which could deal with those problems which cannot be met and dealt with on any of the other lower levels. Some of the suggestions that have been made, Hannah Newcomb, who works as one of the directors of the Canadian Peace Research Institute, has suggested certain reforms in the UN. For example, she suggested that we, the citizens of the various nations, elect their UN representatives directly rather than having them be appointed by the governments, and there are others that are promoting that idea. She's also suggested that membership, representation in the UN, not just be one representative for every nation, because that means that countries that have a million people or less have the same representation that the United States or China or some other country has. She's suggesting that representation in the UN be dependent on two things, per capita income and population. And this would encourage the poor nations to increase their per capita income, but it would also mean, and it would the larger nations had more representatives in the UN. I think the most important thing in this respect is not to say, now here's a plan, but it's to get people thinking in these lines, to get people raising these questions, to get people discussing these matters, to raise the consciousness of people about the need for some sort of a system. Now, many people say, well, that's totally utopian, it's totally illusionary, no such thing can ever be. But I think that we ought, first of all, to look at history. You know, who would have thought 1,000 years ago that there would exist in the world today what are called nation states? Or 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, who would have thought there would have existed the great empires of ancient times? Human history shows that originally human groupings were simply clans, and then they were tribes, and then they were city-states, and then they were empires. And it wasn't always one direction, then it went both ways, but in general it tended in that direction. Larger and larger groupings of human persons. And Harold and Margaret Sprout, who are respected, very respected geopoliticists, geopoliticians in the political science community, and who wrote that book, Toward Politics for the Planet Earth, pointed out that modern weapons technology, as well as communications technology, transportation possibilities, and other kinds of things, industrial technology in general, makes the nation-state system as a way of organizing the earth antiquated, just as much as the invention of gunpowder destroyed the feudal fief. You know, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Don Quixote, with the figure of Don Quixote created by Cervantes, but he was a feudal person in a post-feudal age. He was looking for his windmill, fighting, living on the basis of a vision which was passé. And the Sprouts point out that the reason the feudal fief collapsed was because gunpowder simply rendered its defenses useless. The invention of the cannon and other forms of weaponry made the moat and the castle walls totally inadequate as a defense system. And so the feudal fief collapsed and modern nation states came into existence. Now, there's a very interesting chapter in the Sprouts. It's a big book, thanks a lot. And I wouldn't suggest that you read it all. But that one chapter on the correlation between weapons technology and political organization is very interesting. They point out that in order for a nation state to exist, it has to be able to defend itself. And it became clear even in the Second World War that only the law, in order to be able to do that under modern circumstances, it has to have vast territories into which it can retreat and recoup and then push an invader out. And Sprout said that it became clear in the Second World War that only the largest nation states had that capacity, like the Soviet Union, for example. Now, they suggest, Margaret and Harold Sprout suggest that under the conditions that pertain in weapons technology today, no state can defend itself. There's no defense against the weapons which we have. But besides that, they point out, there's no defense against the kind of infiltration of a social system through modern means of communication. There's no way of keeping a particular segment of the human community hermetically sealed over against other segments of that community. So she's pointing out that it's simply a matter of evolution, history and evolution, whereas up until this century, probably, the nation state was a viable system, a viable way of ordering human life. It is no longer viable anymore unless it is augmented, complemented, supplemented with some kind of a global system, global authority, global structure, minimal, but adequate to the task of enforcing some kind of world order in the international community. What is required if these kinds of changes are to be brought about? Well, obviously, it's kind of alienating in a way to talk about these things, because what can you and I do about them? It seems like they're not part of us. There's something out here that we're talking about. And yet I think we have to overcome somehow this idea that there's a distinction between the inside and the outside. Changes begin when human individuals and human groups begin to become aware of the need for those changes. And they began to promote the idea of those changes and stimulate other people to think about these changes. Every change has to start somewhere. And one of the best things about evolution is that it gives me a view of the world that is not fatalistic. Things are happening, things are changing, things are unfolding. And history is the same way. So I think that, of course, you and I cannot create that, but we can begin to discuss that. We can begin to make that an item of awareness. And I believe that that we should be doing that as Christians, and I'll say why in just a minute as I conclude this section. Ted Lentz, this is a good way of leading into the more religious part of it, Ted Lentz, a man who retired about 70 as a psychologist, became one of the main peace researchers in the country, in the world. I saw him when he was about 90 years old. He was lecturing in Bethany, West Virginia. He had about a 50-year-old wife, and the next time I saw him, I said, "Where's your wife?" And he said, "She died." He was still carrying on. He was very broken up about that. But anyway, he came up with this questionnaire designed to measure the humatriotism of a person, designed to determine how humatriotic we are. He says patriotism's all right, but patriotism is only acceptable in our world today if it's subjected to what he called humatriotism. And that means, how loyal are we to the human race? And he had a rather extensive questionnaire. I taught a course once at Bethany College, and one of my students, or a team of my students, instead of a research project, decided to do a project to determine how the humatriotism level of the campus. And so they interviewed a number of professors and a number of students using Ted Lentz's humatriotism questionnaire. They actually simplified it quite a bit. But I think we have to ask ourselves, how much do we care about the human race, not just how much do we care about our fellow Americans? And we have to see in our world today that in any case, the well-being of America and the people of America, as well as that of every nation, is tied in with the well-being of every other nation. Now, religiously speaking, it seems to me, yeah.
When the Pope and others talked to the United Nations, was there any kind of response on the part of the various sovereign nations that make up the United Nations, favorable or unfavorable to what was being proposed? Has that been dealt with at all within the United Nations structure?
There have been discussions within the UN on the possible reforms of the UN, but the major powers primarily sort of undermine that kind of discussion. And it depends again on the particular government. For example, in our own country, some governments have been more supportive of the UN than others. This is probably the least the most anti-UN government that we've had since the UN was established. The man in Washington who represents the Lutheran World Ministries, Intergovernmental Affairs Office, Martin Sobig, told me that the thing that worries him most about the present government of the United States is its profound anti-UN stance, and he believes that there is a desire to almost to destroy the UN. But of course it hasn't been made. Now he may be wrong about that, but he is dealing with that every day in his job capacity. And I'm only reporting to you what he said. I have not researched that myself, so I don't know if it's correct or not, but he is somebody who ought to have some idea as to what the present, what any particular government's stance toward the UN would be. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier in the talk about some group that had done, like seven different groups that studied the possibilities. Were those different national
yes,
groups?
Yes.
Was there any consensus, or were they quite different?
They were quite different, but they were all were. There also was some consensus. There was a socialist group. There was a group that centered around China. There was a Western group. I think a European group, a South American group, a North American group. And I don't remember what the others were. And those studies are published by the Institute for World Order as paperback books. Yeah, I'm glad to have questions asked or comments made at this point.
Jerry, I think the important thing is saying that that whole issue of evolution of forms of government, that's something that is really new to me, but one we should see that governments evolving change in shape and power, and that perhaps we are ready to see a new growth in understanding instead of saying, well, our own country is only 200 years old, so it is not that it's always been.
Right.
So we should be willing to look at new forms, not as a threat, but as a very normal part of the human process.
Right. It's a question, again, from a to use the evolutionary paradigm, you know, if we believe there's any truth to evolution, we realize that only those life forms which adapt to changed circumstances are able to survive. And it seems to me that it's a question of recognizing that the circumstances under which human life exists today have been changed significantly. Going back again to what I said last week, Einstein said when the atom was split, everything changed in human life except the way we think. And unless we change the way we think, in other words, unless we adapt to this changed circumstances, we're courting unparalleled disaster. The question is not to pass judgment upon the past, but to recognize that the institutions created by the past cannot go on forever serving the needs of the present. That we have to adapt our lives individually to change circumstances in our lives, but we also have to adapt socially and politically to change circumstances. Judy?
And that strikes me as the politics of hope.
Yes, absolutely. As I was writing this, I thought that it really, the politics of hope rests on the premise, I think, that change is possible. And if there's anything that history bears out, it's the idea that change is possible. Change has taken place. Change can be for the better, it can be for the worse. In fact, I think that change is inevitable. But we tend, because we lack historical perspective, we tend to think that the way things are today is the way they've always been, and it's the way they always will be. We tend to forget that human social systems are created by human persons, human beings, over time. Perhaps, I would say as a Christian, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, of the Spirit of God. And to me, it's very interesting to begin to put this whole thing together with some of the insights that we should have had from the very beginning as a Christian community. I mean, because God's will for the human person and for the human community as revealed in the scriptures and in the life of Christ is that we should all be one. We recognize that already there exists in the world today at least one community in which national, cultural, ethnic, racial, class differences are supposed to be of no account whatsoever. Totally irrelevant. And that's the community to which we belong by faith, into which we were incorporated through baptism. And I think that's why it's so appropriate that the Pope is saying these kinds of things, or that Bill Lazarus and the Lutheran World Federation is lifting it. It's a matter of faith. It's a matter of saying, even for people that have not accepted Jesus Christ, Christ died for them. Even for people that have not joined our community, they are our brothers and sisters because they are children of a common ancestry. What, no matter what we believe about the literalness of the story of the garden, I think the important truth communicated there is that we're all one race, we're all one community, we're all one species, we're all intended to be one family. When John the 23rd called his great Vatican II Council, he said a number, he was asked why he did this, and he gave a number of reasons. One was that he said he wanted to let some fresh air in the church. He was asked by some reporters why he called his council, and he didn't answer, he just went to the door, to the windows, and opened the windows. And he said, I wanted some fresh air in the church. And another reason was, he said, I wanted to get everybody sitting around the same table. He said, brothers and sisters might fight with each other, but they don't ordinarily kill each other. And he wanted to symbolically raise up this sense of the unity of the whole human community. And that's why also he invited the Protestant churches, the Orthodox churches, to send official representatives to that council, something that's unheard of, never been done before, and provided opportunities for them to be actively involved in the council. They couldn't vote, they couldn't speak on the floor, but all kinds of forums were arranged in which they were invited to speak and interact with the bishops. But beyond that, if you read the documents of the council, there was not one anathema pronounced except an anathema upon nuclear war. The only anathema pronounced by the Second Vatican Council was upon nuclear weapons and nuclear war. And most councils in the past have been called, one of the primary purposes for calling them together was to pronounce anathemas upon all those people that, that didn't agree with what the Roman Church was teaching. So I think that was a great symbolic attempt on Pope's part to show that the purpose of the Church is to further the cause of human unity in God and in Christ, and even for those, we are united in love, even with those who have not been baptized, who have not accepted Jesus Christ. Because whether they've accepted Jesus Christ or not, Jesus Christ died for them as much as he died for us. And God loves them as much as he loves us. I spent some time at the community of Taizé in France and made some retreats there. And I remember the speeches that Frère Roger, the prior, used to give. And he said that the primary vocation of the monks at Taizé was to further the cause of the unity of the Church. But he always added, the unity of the Church is not the end. The Church must be one in order to further the cause of human unity. And Roger, the monks of Taizé, Frère Roger among them, go regularly to live in Hong Kong or in China and Latin America with the poorest of the poor, also in non-Christian cultures. And he says, when we go there, we do not go there with the idea of bringing Christ to those cultures. We go with the idea of finding Christ there. And they always do find Christ, because there's no place on this earth where Christ is not present, whether we're aware of his presence or not. So it seems to me that this effort to bring about a greater sense of unity and order, humane order in the world, is not foreign to our mission as Christians at all. That doesn't mean, and it doesn't mean that we don't stand for anything, that we're just all blah. We stand for something. We fight for things that we believe in, but we try to find ways of standing for that and fighting for that which are as creative and as little destructive as possible. And that brings me to the second point, but I don't want to, I can do that tomorrow or the next time too if we don't. The other point that goes with this is that we need to find ways of dealing with our problems and conflicts that do not rely on the massive use of lethal violence, and that's what this other part is about. Go ahead, though.
I think the word change raises all kinds of negative flags for us as individual humans, like to live our lives within the realm of the secure, what we know. And I was reading in Dan Erlander's Baptism of Lutheran Way of Life last night, and he was talking about change within the church. And for many people, change in the church means that we destroy tradition. Mm-hmm. And he made the point that change doesn't mean the destruction of tradition. It just means that we adapt the conventions that we use, like how we set the chairs, where we put the altar, you know, how we serve communion, where the baptismal font rests, and all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can begin as a world order of nations, recognizing that we still have tradition, you know, within what it is we're trying to accomplish, and if we can adjust those conventions to adapt to the new order. That gave a new definition of the word change.
Yes. I've discovered that often when we talk about change in the church, the kind of changes that have that have occurred in the church very often are going back to the roots. And they are resting on a much more primitive understanding of Christianity. Of course, that could be good or bad, too. We have to evaluate it in each individual situation. I mean, the idea of bringing the altar out and having the people around it, that's going back to early Christianity, and a new understanding of what the Eucharist is about. And it should be done just to change where the table's at, but only because we have a new understanding of the Eucharist informed by a new awareness of the biblical teaching on that. But change itself, I think, is inevitable. I mean, absolutely. We're all aging, for example. Our grandparents die. Our parents die. Our lives simply are not the same as they were 10, 20 years ago. My last grandparent died last November. And I thought to myself, that cuts me off now from any kind of a tangible relationship with that whole generation of people that have passed away. And for the first 25 years of my life, I was surrounded by any number of people, 19th century people. My life has changed. I think part of learning to accept our humanity and our limitedness is learning to accept the fact there's nothing we can do about change. Sometimes we can affect the direction of change, making it go one way rather than the other, and in terms of the political life of our world, that's what we ought to try to do. But mostly it's just a question of how we're going to relate to the sort of change which takes place. And perhaps if we can get the sense of all this being in the hands of God, then maybe, certainly at least some of this change is the result of God's presence and God's working in the world. Not all of it. Some of it could be the work of the devil, too. But, I mean, it could well be that some of the changes that are taking place are God moving us in the direction that he wants us to move in. There was another hand over here.
I was just going to make a couple of comments. First of all, I really appreciate the kind of things that Jerry has been sharing. One of the reasons I'm the Lowell he referred to and did some of this stuff last week, Lowell Erdahl, that I think that Jerry is absolutely brilliant and insightful in all this is because I found someone finally in my pilgrimage of life who seems to agree. It seems to me to be so essential.
Lowell and I have been patting each other on the back all week.
Magnificent. I think that this concept of seeking to work for the creation of global structures that are consistent with what we've sung so often, that in Christ there is no east or west, no north or south, that's inherent in our faith. It's not just some political business. I don't think it's not utopian. I was talking up under the tree here just a few minutes ago with Doreen Scribner, who's on his way up to Stehika now, would like to be here. And I made a little comment about, I know some think this is utopian, and he said, not at all.
And he's a politician.
He's a politician.
Extensive political experience.
And he said that one of the best examples is in Europe today. Who would have imagined 50 years ago, back in 1932, that Europe would have the kind of united community, economic and otherwise, mm-hmm. that we have today? You couldn't believe right. that. And yet these things are done out of, they're not out of necessity.
Yes.
Others of us think they ought to be done also out of Christian conviction.
Well, I think we are faced with necessity on this matter. I really believe that this German political scientist who said that by the year 2000 we will either solve this problem of world order or we will blow each other up. And so it is necessity. But as Christians, it ought to be vocation as well. It seems to me that, I mean, a war between the nations of Western Europe is unthinkable today. Couldn't happen. Their structures are far too integrated for a war even to be thinkable. And that has happened in 30 years. Within 30 years. I mean, 40 years ago, the nations of Europe were tearing each other apart, killing each other by the millions. That is impossible today. And I think that not only do things happen, things change, but sometimes things change very rapidly, far more rapidly than we would expect them to change.
Just a couple other quick things. One, I think of a text in relation to this, that when they said the crowd should be quiet, and Jesus said, if these are silenced, the very stones will call out. I think the hard rock realities of life are calling out with the same voice of Christ that says, really, repent or perish, unite or perish, one world or no world. Then one other thing, Jerry asked me yesterday if I had some materials to bring along. I just mentioned I do have with me a little pamphlet on the World Federalists. I think this is a very interesting organization. He's been talking about federalism. It's not communism. We are a federal structure. Every country of the world that has a civilized system has some kind of federal, what do you call it, subsidiary or whatever kind of structure. I also have some addresses, I have some addresses too, of the Institute for World Order. I have the reference to the book, World Peace Through World Law. If you've never read that, it's a big book. Don't let it scare you. Read the first 33 pages and scan the rest. It's a very interesting book. Tremendously challenging for us. I quit, thank you.
Those first 33 pages have been published in a separate paperback, just a small little book that could be purchased on its own. Thank you very much. Lowell has an article in the last issue of World and...
Word and World.
And he has in footnotes the addresses of some of these groups.
That's right.
So you might want to check that out, those of you that subscribe to that, and if you don't. I think the point that Lowell and I are trying to make now is that these are questions that it is appropriate for the church to be raising in among the Christian people, in adult forums, in youth groups, and from time to time, even in sermons, when the texts lead us in that way. You wanted to say something, though.
Yeah, I'm sitting here wondering, you mentioned something about each country wanted to be sovereign.
Uh-huh.
How in the world do we go about breaking down sovereignty?
That's the question.
I don't know. The only thing that I can see that we can do is to raise the question and to begin to help people to see. I mean, I think that very often the leaders follow the people, not lead them. And if there is a sense among the people of the need for this sort of thing, then I think the chances are increased of that. I mean, there are leaders, there are members of Congress who belong to the World Federalists and other organizations, but they can't do anything or move in that direction until there's some support for that among the people. So the only thing that I think we can do, that's where we're not powerless, is to raise these questions among the people and try to develop that kind of a support. Les Aspin, the congressman from Wisconsin, who spoke to us at a conference on the arms race in Washington last February, said that there will be no real commitment to restrain the defense budget in our country in Congress until there is a constituency among the people that supports that and makes himself known, and that is a solid constituency that doesn't flip over every time the Russians invade Afghanistan or something like that. And so and he said that's where we come in. And Chuck Lewis sent me an article some years ago that said the way in which the church influences the political process primarily is to create a constituency among the people for these kinds of concerns, because they're really religious and spiritual concerns. If they're the people there in our society, and to a far lesser extent, but still to some extent, that's also true in totalitarian. Now, even a totalitarian regime cannot be totally irresponsive to the demands of its people and stay in power indefinitely. Yeah.
Just one comment on that. It seems to me that our nation is one that almost seems the least willing to give up any of its sovereignty. And that seems so contradictory if we're some kind of Christian democracy, you might say. If we look at our biblical perspective, we should be the ones most willing to give that up for the greater order for the globe.
And there are ways that we could give it up without even really sacrificing anything. For example, the law of the sea was almost ready to sign until the present government took over, but it scuttled the whole thing. And the reason is it doesn't want any laws, international laws, limiting what the multinational corporations can do to expropriate the riches of the sea. Now, there is a case of a treaty where we could very easily agree to an international law and agree to allow that law to be enforced without it's really threatening our national security much at all. But we're unwilling to do that. It's part of our ideology. And I believe there is a fight and there is a struggle within American history between good things and bad things. There's some really wonderful things that came into the world with the emergence of America as a nation state. I think wonderful things. A leap forward in terms of governmental processes. But there's also that kind of macho and that also very, very vicious individualism that we have to fight against. Alexis de Tocqueville, when he was here and wrote this History of America in the early 1900s, said that the country was based upon two contradictory principles. One was the principle of covenant community, people covenanting together and assuming together responsibility for the public life. But the other strand that he detected in American society was a very extreme form of individualism. And he felt that there was a very good chance, he predicted that in his writing, that this violent, almost individualism, would dissolve the sense of public covenant and public responsibility. And I think that that's what we're up against now within the country, and also then in terms of our relationships with other nations. But we have to, as Christian community again, we have to get back to strengthening that positive strand in American society, which was derived from Christian teaching, the covenant, the idea of covenant, and a democratic covenant. Molly?
How do you respond to the attitude that it's capitalism that has made our country great?
Well, I think it's an oversimplification.
Pretty complicated.
Yeah, well, I think there's no question that that capitalism, not only in terms of our country, but in terms of the world as a whole, has enabled us to produce an enormous amount of goods and services, has led us to organize our industrial life in such a way as to produce a great deal. But capitalism has also created a lot of problems, and I think capitalism is at the root of this individualism, which threatens to destroy public responsibility, this kind of dog-eat-dog philosophy. The question is, can we retain the benefits of capitalism, which are a sense of initiative and innovation and emphasis on productivity, and integrated in a different kind of framework? It seems to me that when we move forward in history, we take a lot of the past with us. We don't turn against it all. We take it with us, but we reorganize it, reorder it, integrate it in a different vision. And I think that's what we have to do with. I mean, capitalism has created some things that are of permanent value to the human community, but I think it served its purpose, and it needs to be at least modified, restrained somehow.
Both Lowell and I will be working this afternoon with the concept of interdependence and limits and that sort of thing. And it seemed to me, as people become more aware and denying less the reality that we are limited, that they will sense the need for interdependence, which is a beginning of breaking down that sovereignty cry. And maybe at that point, that's where we begin to have some creative initiative so that that capitalistic spirit is lost.
To me, there's something true. I mean, we do have to take responsibility for our lives, for our faith. There are times when we as an individual have to say no, have to put up the price for that. So we can't just be integrated totally in this collective. But at the same time, we have to find the right balance between sort of personal responsibility and individuality and public accountability. It seems to me, and I think Christianity teaches us this too, that very often the problem is not that this group doesn't have the truth, this group doesn't have truth, and this group has the truth, as that there's truth in both things, and the real struggle is how to bring those things together in this kind of dialectical tension, which makes things alive rather than dead. The individual person is a very important and precious thing and cannot just be integrated like a brick in a house. But at the same time, that individual person finds his or her fulfillment by becoming a part of the larger community of people and being fed by and feeding into that, you know. It's not easy to find these balances. Yeah.
Well, your talk is very persuasive, and particularly with a group of believers here, and we probably had a consensus in this room, and you go to the edge of our seat. Now we want to hear about what's the recipe for doing it.
Well, as I said, I think the only thing that I can do, and I think it may not be quite true with you, it depends on your individual life circumstance, your vocational circumstance, and so forth, but I would say that the only thing that probably all of us could do, at least this much we could do, is to raise these questions, and we shouldn't think that that's unimportant. Because nothing every change, it seems to me, of significance since the human species evolved takes place first in the human consciousness. And then out of that changed consciousness, groups of people organize to affect these changes in external reality. I mean, the American Revolution would not have been possible if it hadn't been for the French and the British philosophers who created the conceptual system out of which that evolved. And it would not have been possible apart from the dissemination of those kinds of concepts and those kinds of awarenesses. And that often takes 200 or 300 years before we find, before the results of this begin to be evident in terms of external structures. I think what we can do is to be evangelists for this, for these ideas. Not saying that we have the solutions to the problems, but at least we've identified what the important questions are, So much of what goes on in the church and in society in general is a discussion of the wrong questions. Once we begin to discuss the right questions, the questions that are of relevance, we're already really on the right track. And gradually, I believe this thing, but we want to be omnipotent. We want to be able to snap our fingers now and create something. It's not the same thing as going home and making a batch of jelly or canning, you know, tomatoes. I can get a great deal of satisfaction out of helping my wife with that and seeing at the end of the day. And I remember when I was a child, my grandmother lived with us at the end of the day in the canning season. She'd have the whole kitchen table full of green beans and tomatoes, and this gave you the most wonderful feeling. And we'd like to be able to do that with questions of this sort. We'd like to be able to go home and can it up. But in fact, it's going to be a long-term struggle. We got to start opening our mouths and raising the issues.
Except we don't have a lot of time.
Well, we don't know how much time we have, but as long as we're still alive, we have to do it. And it may happen faster than we think. Now, some of you, if you're directly involved in politics, may be able to do more than that. But for me, I don't see much more than I can do at this time, but I'm not going to think that that's unimportant. And every one of you that joins in that effort multiplies the effectiveness of it and makes it likelier to happen sooner. Yes, Lord.
One thing I have to say here, that you know, a few years ago, when these ideas began to enter into my head, and I began to study these things, I was absolutely amazed at the amount of work that's been done on these subjects.
Yes.
This may come to us as entirely new. There
yes.
have been people working their whole life and for generations, people, have been, and the stuff is coming together.
Yes.
I read a thing by George Kennan recently when he said he looked again at that book, World Peace Through World Law, and he said, this stuff begins to look increasingly realistic.
Wow. Yeah.
And we look at what's happening in Europe and answer your question, how do you get nations to give up their sovereignty? They give up their sovereignty when they realize it's not in their self-interest. But they cannot survive without it.
Yes. The other thing that we can do is to work politically in our own country to elect legislators and executives that, I mean, even our president or Congress can't create this, but they can be the kind of people that are open to discussing it and to considering it. And nobody on earth has the power to create this. But one of the issues that we ought to force into the political arena, it seems to me, in our country, are these kinds of issues. And we ought to begin to insist that our politicians discuss these kinds of things. Because if they're anti-world order and are going to do everything that they can to prevent this from emerging, just be obstructionists, then you can be sure that we're going to delay. I mean, if they have this idea, this individualism begins with the person, but it goes right on up to the national level, then by God, we're the nations, the world's number one nation, and nobody's going to tell us what to do, nobody's going to inhibit us, nobody's going to regulate us. And we don't need those kinds of people in leadership positions today. We need people that are rational and that can deal rationally. I mean, that are rational in the sense that they face the realities of our time. I mean, I think President Reagan is rational in his framework. I don't think he's crazy. But I think that, and I think he's a nice guy, but I think that he hasn't really faced up to these realities. And in that respect, he's no different from so many others in our society. I want to underscore also what Lowell said. Read this stuff. Inform yourself, because the more informed you are, the better you can help others to become informed. It's a movement that we have to promote, and it's connected to the movement of our lives, namely Christianity. Yes, indeed. And Tim, I mean.
Yeah, right. I'd like to pose a question. I realize there's not very much time. And then add a couple comments. First of all, if you're wondering what's the recipe or how we can move from a nation-state system into a world government, I think you have to look at why we have sovereign states in the first place. And I think there are two basic reasons, or two categories. One is economic, and the other is defense. One is based on self-interest, trading things of trust, and the other is based upon mistrust, or not trusting in other people. And I think what Einstein is trying to get at when he says that our thinking hasn't changed is that in this world where we have weapons of such a destructive capacity, there's no longer such a thing as grouping people together, coming together in terms of defending themselves from other groups of people, that we are all just as vulnerable, that in fact we need to stress more of an economic interdependence, mm-hmm. And that in fact can be based upon individual or individualism because of self-interest. Economics works. And I think that there, in my personal opinion, there seems to be two ways of motivating people. The first way is to have some kind of a cause. In other words, there are two ways to bring people together. You either have a cause or you have an enemy. And I think that where our minds need change, what Einstein is trying to get at, is instead of thinking in terms of enemy, we have to start thinking in terms of cause, in terms of whole, in terms of coming together as in our own self-interest.
Thank you. Tomorrow, that's very interesting, and if it's true that the nation-state system is based on those two principles, then both of them are sort of bankrupt today, because not only is defense impossible, but economic self-sufficiency is impossible as well, as we should have learned, for example, from the oil boycott and all these kinds of things. All of this simply points to the fact that the systems which we operate under today are antiquated and unable to deal with contemporary reality. There's a bibliography back there that has some of this stuff on it, but also has a lot of stuff that I referred to last week. On Wednesday, if any of you are interested, we will do the second part of what I intended to do today, talking about beyond violence, an alternative to violence as a means of exercising power in the international political arena. And also, then I think there'll be time at the end of that session to do what was originally announced for Wednesday, namely talk about bibliographical resources.
What time is that session Wednesday?
I think it's at 4 o'clock.
I really would, Jerry is modest and humble. I would really urge all of you to be here at that session, to invite your friends to come. I see that he has in front of him there Gene Sharp's book, Social Power and Political Freedom, I think is the title of that one. If you're going to be gone, there's some other things by Sharp, The Politics of Nonviolent Action. That's a whole new area. That's tremendous stuff to think about. And some of us think, again, just really consistent with the whole call of Christ to take up our cross. Again, theologically, Christianly based material. And I just want to cheerlead for all of you coming to that session.
I asked him to be here today, but I didn't ask him to say that.
Are those books available from the bookstore?
This book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, that's the first volume. Sharp is a bit wordy. He goes into every detail of everything you can imagine. But this little book is very helpful. And there's another one that's a pamphlet called Making the Abolition of War a Realistic Goal, available from the Institute for World Order for just $1. If any of you, that's not in the bookstore, but that can be ordered. I really urge you to take a look at that stuff.